Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have a special show for you featuring an in-depth interview with Mike Harrison. Some of you may know him as an aide to Congressman Duncan Hunter, and he is a candidate for the 71st Assembly District. We'll be airing our interview that was taped in late November, talking about some of the top East County issues. In addition, on Destination East County, we'll have all the most fun and festive holiday happenings for you coming up across East County this week, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today, my very special guest is Mike Harrison. Mike is a candidate for the 71st Assembly District, and he's currently the Deputy Chief of Staff for Congressman Duncan Hunter. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
In addition to working for Congressman Hunter for 20 years, you've also got a degree in government, I understand, from Johns Hopkins University and from Cal State University Stanislaus in political science. You've obviously been interested in politics your whole life. What made you finally decide to throw your own hat in the ring?
I actually did not have a huge itching to run for public office. I thoroughly enjoy public policy. I've been given a great opportunity to work for Congressman Hunter. I worked for his father before him in Washington, D.C., and I do have a love for public policy and finding solutions to issues that people are facing. But we have an open seat coming up here in 2016 in the State Assembly, and with 21 years actually of experience between the congressman and his father, and it's being an open seat, it was too much of an important seat to not take advantage of the opportunity to provide what I've learned and the ways I've been able to serve to take advantage of that and make a run for it.
Now, this is the district that is currently represented by Assemblyman Brian Jones, who, as you've noted, is termed out. Mm-hmm. There are three candidates who've declared so far, although, of course, we're not up to the filing deadline, so there could be more. But as of right now, it's three Republicans, yourself, Santee Mayor Randy Vopel, and Tony Tiora. So tell us a little bit about the district for those who may not know if they're in the 71st Assembly District, especially with reapportionment recently. What areas does this district include now?
The 71st District is a great district. It is a backcountry district. It goes from the border with Mexico all the way north into southern Riverside County, all the way up to Idlewild. East side, it borders the Imperial County line. And on the west side, you get all the way to the unincorporated parts of La Mesa. So geographically, very large, great rural area. The only two cities, incorporated cities in the entire district are Santee and El Cajon. The rest are all unincorporated areas, backcountry.
So yeah, areas a lot of rural towns.
Yeah, a lot of little rural towns, a lot of little areas and communities that are great people, and they have specific issues. And they need to have somebody serving them that knows each of them specifically. I know the difference between Julian and Homol. I know the issues that are going on as much as in Ramona as I do in Santee or Lakeside. And so that's one of those areas where people really do appreciate when you are in contact with them and you know what's going on in their communities. That really is important to them as they make decisions on who's going to represent them in places like Sacramento.
Yeah, that's a good point, because some of the other candidates aren't from East County. Well, in Tony's case, he's from the northern part of the district. In Randy's case, he's been the mayor of Santee, but that doesn't necessarily translate into a knowledge of the broader district as a whole. I mean, do you think that's kind of an advantage that you have, having worked for the congressman and having had contact and familiarity with issues in many of those towns that perhaps the other two would have to come up to speed on.
Right. Well, not speaking as towards their qualifications, because I do not know how much time that they've spent in other parts of the district, but mm-hmm. I do know that my work experience for 21 years, this district has primarily been represented by Congressman Hunter and his dad before him. These are areas that I've worked in. These are areas where I've followed, I've been involved with for two decades now. If you look at people who have endorsed me, I'm very proud of it, because they're not just people who say, hey, Mike's a great guy.
Yeah.
There are elected officials from former members of Congress to school boards, water boards, land planning groups, city councils, all over the district, because they've worked with me. They know my body of work. They know what I bring to the table. And so, you know, East County is very unique in the challenges that it has and the people it represents. And it also fits in with the bigger, larger area of San Diego County as a whole. And so I think being able to having worked for Congressman Hunter for so long, and been given that opportunity to learn those things and work on those things, is definitely one of my stronger qualifications.
I'd like to go through a list of some of the issues in this race, starting with jobs, certainly on most everybody's mind out here. In East County, many of these communities we've just mentioned actually have very high unemployment rates compared to, say, the more urban areas of San Diego. So what would your plan be to try to foster more job opportunities for people?
Well, what people don't quite seem to grasp in Sacramento is that Sacramento is unique in the sense that it actually takes pride in the fact that it's driving jobs out of California, which is something that I do not understand. When jobs leaves, you know, when businesses leave, jobs leave. When jobs leaves, family leave. And that affects us at all different levels of government. This is a direct correlation to overregulation that's coming out of Sacramento. The business environment, the business model should be invest and grow. I'm going to take advantage of these opportunities. I'm going to grow my business. I'm going to open up new places and create new jobs. But right now in California, and particularly in San Diego County, the business environment is hang on. Hang on until I can retire, or hang on until I can move out to Texas or to South Dakota or what have you. And so they're directly related. And what we have to do is we have to come with common sense, practical solutions on creating a business environment that is not openly hostile to business development and to job development. You know, East County is a great area for people to live and to raise mm-hmm. their families. But if you outprice them in terms of home or poor quality education and don't give them jobs in which to stay and live, they're going to move elsewhere.
Yeah, good point.
So businesses are a big part of that. You know, I got a list a mile long. I printed out a list of every government, state agency and department in the state of California, and it's longer than Santa's Christmas list. There is a level of spending and redundancy and overregulation that takes place that has a direct effect on our business development and our job creation ability.
Let's talk about education. Can you share your views on that important issue?
I mean, education is obviously the lifeblood of our future. We have to ensure that our kids are going to be able to compete not only locally as here in our area, but if they move to other parts, we want to keep as many people here, whatever opportunities they have. But if they move to other parts of the country and aren't equipped in the skills to do whatever it is they want to pursue, they're not going to be able to do it. And, you know, let's face facts. We're in a global competition now. California is the 8th largest economy in the world, and not just the United States, in the world. And so we need to have education opportunities for our kids to be able to pursue whatever it is that they want to do and whatever fields that they want to do. Our potential is high. California has always been a great place to be educated, like I said before, raise a family. But we get so caught up in these side issues of trying to create a curriculum that's dictated out of Washington, D.C. or Sacramento.
Too much teaching to the test, you think?
Exactly. I mean, look, you got varying areas of needs between places like Lakeside and Ramona. Completely different. One place may need facilities. One place may need teachers.
Yeah.
While El Cajon may need new textbooks, while Homol may need, you know, better iPads, what have you. How are you going to be able to dictate from Sacramento, let alone D.C., the needs of each school district like that. This is an area that I believe the more local control that you can provide to school districts, the better quality of education that you're going to give to our kids. And I think it's definitely an area that parents are taking notice in. I'm a parent of two myself. I have my kids in public school. I'm a product of public school. And, you know, I know what works and I know what I've, when I seen things that don't work. And so through that personal experience, parents want the, they know that they have a responsibility in their kids. And if they feel like their school system can't do it because they're being dictated to by Sacramento, I don't think that's very fair to them. And so again, education is huge. I want to invest in that as much as possible. But again, I think as much local control that we can provide is in the overall best benefit of our students.
Okay. Let's move on to talk about transportation, energy, and the environment. You've stated that you oppose the bullet train and that you...
100%.
Okay. Tell us why and what you would do instead.
I'll answer your question with a question. Who here is in that big of a rush to get to Modesto or Fresno, right?
Good point.
I mean, here's the thing. That bullet train, the idea and concept, this is one of those things where ideas and concepts sound good, but when you actually start doing it in practicality, it's not working. We are investing billions and billions of taxpayer dollars to create an infrastructure to do a high-speed rail through the middle of the Central Valley when the whole purpose of it was to create a high-speed rail from LA to San Francisco. So not only are you geographically now in the wrong place, but it's over budget. So we're spending more than we ever did. And the state government is exercising eminent domain, taking people's personal property away from them.
You mentioned that includes a lot of the agricultural lands in California.
We are the breadbasket of the United States. Yeah. The Central Valley and Imperial Valleys provide food to this country year round.
Now, you grew up in the Imperial Valley.
I did.
Another controversy we've seen recently here in both the Imperial County and also San Diego's East County is the use of agricultural lands for these massive scale solar farms or even wind farms. But I'm wondering what your views are on that. This kind of rolls into our next topic, which is energy. I guess I would preface it by saying at the state level, the policy has been pushing forward for California to get 30% or so of its energy, electricity from renewables by, I think it's 2030, you know, with the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But the incentives all seem to be toward these utility-scale projects like the Desert Solar and the Big Wind projects where they're actually taking away a lot of the incentives for, say, you or I to put solar on our rooftops. What do you think about all of that?
I think renewable energy is a very worthwhile goal. I think it's important that we become energy independent. Mm-hmm. And I believe in an all-the-above approach. Mm-hmm. I believe that solar is just as good as geothermal, as wind, as a lot of the other things that we've been able to come up with. And I think they work directly and just as beneficial as traditional fossil fuels as well. Nuclear is a great source of energy. And all the other traditional things, I don't believe one is worse than the other.
A nuke, by the way, what do you think about the nuke storage at San Onofre? That's a hot issue kind of emerging right now.
Well,
the nuclear waste now that it's shut down.
Well, I mean, we have a responsibility to protect the environment. I mean, nobody wants to see, that's something that we protect for ourselves and for future generations.
Should that waste be moved somewhere else or should it stay where it is?
I think, I don't know how qualified I am on to answer that. I think it should be handled responsibly. But here's the point is that we have great renewable resources here in Southern California, mm-hmm. right? But they have to be done in a manner that is respecting the neighborhoods in which they're located.
Yeah, that seems to be missing.
Putting in wind turbines in a community where people are getting sick and it's adversely affecting their quality of life, there's plenty of other places to put in wind turbines, okay? And if wind turbines don't work somewhere, then use something else. If you're going to install solar panels all over desert places that we use for recreational off-roading mm-hmm. and you take land access away, public access to public lands in an effort to develop solar, I don't think that that's right either. I think that there's a balance that takes place. Mm-hmm. And here's the other thing. You cannot – what's happening is that the state of California is exercising – a strong effort for people to be more energy independent and to exercise renewable energy. So get solar panels on your rooftops. And that's great. Then there's a number of ways you can do that. You can buy them. You can lease them. You can do programs with the county.
But they're taking away the
But they take away the incentives.
Tax credits,
They take away the tax credits to do it. They take away the incentives. And they say when a certain number of the populace of the state reach a certain percentage in terms of obtaining solar, we're going to stop giving you certain rates.
And yet we're still incentivizing, say, the utility companies
we
to go out and do massive
The energy that our solar panels produce that we sell back to SDG&E, we will soon be selling back at a lesser price than what we get and pay for. So why can't we exercise free market values, free market principles of competition and common sense and incentivize people to do the things you want instead of overregulating it, make it so complicated that people don't want to get involved with it in the first place.
Yeah.
Why are you going to tell us that you have to install solar panels out in the middle of the desert and take land away from off-roaders because we're pursuing this energy policy when there's a way to balance both? I grew up in Imperial County. Geothermal was very big out there, and there's a lot of land out there where you could put solar panels where nobody goes.
Yeah, and they're doing a lot of geothermal now around the Salton Sea. We just had Bruce Wilcox in for an interview.
Yeah, Salton Sea is a huge issue as well. But, you know, my point is that we have so many alternatives available to us that there's no reason that we have to be so myopic that we're only focused on one where it's adversely affecting communities and people's lives.
Yeah, there you go. One issue where your other two opponents have polar opposite viewpoints, Mike, is on the issue of climate change. Randy Vopel famously told a bunch of climate change protesters or folks holding a climate change party, enjoy your wreck the economy party. I like it hot. He is an adamant global warming or climate change denier. On the other hand, Tony Tiora actually has a background in science and says that's one area where he differs from most in the Republican Party, and that he actually does believe that climate change is real, that it's man-made, and that we should be doing something to try to address the issue. Where do you stand on that issue?
On any environmental policy, I have two criteria: sound science and common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's what I base it all on. So, for example, to answer this question, going back to water, we've dumped 1.4 trillion gallons of water into the ocean, fresh water, into the ocean to protect fish, a Delta smelt up in Sacramento. That defies common sense. It defies sound science. So climate change, I do believe that we have had changes in the climate. I look at scientific evidence. I'm not a scientist. I do see that there are variations. But I don't think it's to the degree of concern that we have to change every part of our economic and regulatory processes to combat. They do explain to us that you can do a footprint of the environment to see what part of it's man-made and what part of it's not. But we also know that natural things can happen that affect the climate, whether it be a volcanic eruption or a number or solar flare. So it happens.
Yeah.
It's things that we deal with. But at the same time, I think we have to be prudent in how we move about it. And I think it's what the evidence that I have always seen and I've never quite understood is that they'll say, the earth, you know, get varying degrees on how old the earth is, right? But people say it's billions of years old. And the scientists say that based on evidence of the last 200 years, we can definitively prove this climate change is occurring. Well, 200 years out of billions of years is like saying, I'm going to tell you exactly what's happened over 24 hours based on 3 seconds.
We have the 97% of the climatologists or climate scientists in the world basically say that it's man-made and that it's accelerated since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution.
And I will take issue with that figure because that's 97% of a figure of people that were already predisposed to a certain position. You don't have 97% of the entire world scientist population. It was one group because I've heard that figure before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to tell them that they're wrong. I mean, they've studied this and I'm sure I have a lot to learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
But saying that 97% of all environmental scientists agree on something, that's just not accurate.
That said, moving toward renewable resources, you know, I've heard it said that there's reasons to support that even if you don't believe in climate change or you're not sure if it's man-made.
It's smart policy.
Well, do we want to be, you know, dependent forever on Middle East oil, given the political turmoil over there, for example?
No, I mean, it's practical. I mean, I'm all for energy independence, and I love the fact that we're making ourselves more reliant upon our own natural resources. But here's the thing. we push towards that and we say that's a stated goal and then we overregulate it. Why do we do that? That's the type of thing that drives me crazy. Sure. I don't want to be dependent on foreign oil as much as anybody else. So let's do those renewable energy sources, you know, but what they do is they overregulate it to the point that when you pursue the incentives are gone. And what are we experiencing here? The state of California has invested itself in pursuing those policies of energy and gas independence, but yet it won't invest in any type of refineries. It won't invest in any type of incentive program for the citizenry. So we have the highest gas prices of the nation. We have the highest energy costs of the nation. But yet we're committed more than the other. See, it doesn't balance out.
Doesn't quite fit. Let's move on and talk about taxes, a favorite Republican topic. I understand that you've signed a no new taxes pledge. And
yes.
You also have some views I'm sure you'd like to share about Proposition 13.
Absolutely. So I was very proud to sign a pledge that said I would not vote for any legislative effort that would raise or create new taxes. I do not see that as a gimmick. I see it as a measure of accountability.
Do you see any potential exception if, for example, we had a terrible natural disaster or, heaven forbid, a terrorist attack or something like that?
I do not think that we have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. And in those cases, there are plenty of resources in which we would be able to address a crisis like that. We always have in the past and we always will. But see, right now we are the most heavily taxed state in the entire country in terms of so many different areas. There was an article in the Union Tribune about how businesses continue to leave the state of California because of the hostile business environment, and taxes are a big part of that. So that's our taxpayer dollars. You could take the money that we're utilizing for the bullet train and use that for so many different things, whether it be better water management and water infrastructure, mm-hmm. or to have it for emergency response like wildfires that we have out here in East County.
And hold that thought. I want to talk more about water and fire, but we didn't get to the Prop 13 issue. You mentioned there's an effort out there right now. I think, is it a ballot initiative coming up that would?
It's a split roll.
Yeah, it'd be a split roll. I'll let you go ahead and explain it. But basically, it would modify Proposition 13 somewhat, which, of course, was the longstanding initiative that protects people who've owned their homes for a long time or the businesses for a long time from a big property tax increase.
Exactly. Prop 13 is the one thing that California has that actually attracts property and business development and investment, because people know that whatever they purchase their price of their property for, their taxes are not going to elevate or decrease or go up and down, mm-hmm. you know, radically. They have a strong base of what their tax base is going to be. That has created job growth and property investment in the state of California. But because that spending is such a problem by Sacramento, then they cannot keep their hands off any avenue in which to get new money. Now they're taking the one thing that spurs business growth in California and they want to ruin it by doing a split roll. So basically what they would do is they would say Prop 13 would only apply to residential or primary dwelling places. And if you have a business or an investment property somewhere else, it would be subject to escalating tax increases. But what they're doing is they're taking little things that were never meant to be business investments and including that in there. So, for example, my parents had a little condo in El Centro. My mom passed away. My dad moved to Tennessee. I've kept that condo. I rent it out. And it's just one of those properties I wanted to keep because it was in my family. According to this split rule, that would be considered a commercial investment. And so therefore it would be subject to tax increases as opposed to my primary dwelling spot here in California where we live. That would be protected. So let me ask you this. If you're trying to attract people to come to California to invest and do different types of purchases and investment and growth, but you're telling them on top of all the high taxes and the hostile environment and the overregulation that now you can't count on Prop 13 protection either, who in their right mind is going to come here and invest?
Very good point from a business and investment standpoint. The flip side of the argument, I guess, would be that in California, certainly been through some tough times with the recent economic downturn, but that there are programs such as, I'll give one example, programs for the disabled where there hasn't been really an increase in that sometimes there's been cuts or no increase for many, many, many years. How do you balance that to protect, say, the needs of the disabled or programs out here like Noah's Home or St. Madeline mm-hmm. Sophie, very popular charities out here? How do you balance that versus the need to also protect property owners' interests?
I'll answer your question again with another question. Mm-hmm. What's a bigger problem to St. Madeline Sophie's or Noah Homes? Prop 13 or a bullet train? So my point is this. Again, we don't have a revenue problem. We have the money. California is fully qualified to take care of its citizenry. It always has.
So you would support maybe reallocating some resources to help those disabled programs that haven't seen any?
I mean, absolutely. They're a great resource to the community, and I think the local governments have a responsibility, and we should give them the flexibility to provide for them as needed. And, you know, I'm not against all taxes. I think that, you know, that there is a obviously an important role for government to take care of the needs of the community. Mm-hmm. But you can't tell me that spending billions and billions upon billions of dollars for a train that nobody wants, it's not even high speed anymore.
Really?
And I don't mean to keep going back to the bullet train. I'm just saying it's the most severe example that I've got of wasteful spending that I could think of off the top of my head. But, you know, you've got such mismanagement of taxpayer dollars with that bullet train. And yet we're going to continue that program and keep myopically looking at that. And then we're going to take the one thing that creates businesses and jobs and provide some tax stability in Prop 13, and we're going to tear that apart. That's just illogical.
Let's move on to water issues. Very important. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we've been through 4 years of drought, and now we seem to suddenly be getting a little of the opposite here with the El Nino and the extreme wet winter, but we don't know yet if that's going to be enough to really end the drought or not. So what are your ideas for addressing California's water needs and specifically San Diego County's water needs?
This goes back to the renewable energy question. I believe in an all-the-above approach. San Diego County for the last 20 years has been fantastic in maximizing its water portfolio.
Yeah.
20 years ago, we were 95% reliant upon water from Metropolitan Water District. That mm-hmm. is where all of our water came from. Since then, we've introduced reclamation projects. We've raised the dam at San Vicente. We've been engaged in a purchase agreement with Imperial County and the IID. We've engaged in desal. We obviously have engaged in conservation. We have done a fantastic job. And so now we're still about 50-55% dependent upon MET, which we can do better, mm-hmm. But we're so much better than where we were before. But the question therein is, okay, what do we do moving forward? And it doesn't help when Governor Brown issues this emergency proclamation that we all need to cut back 20% of our water.
When some already have done so.
When we in here in San Diego County have already done it. We as ratepayers mm-hmm. have invested millions of dollars to raise that dam at San Vicente so we have greater surface storage. We as ratepayers have invested in what Carlsbad is doing with desal. So what you've basically done is when you say you're not going to get credit for the things that you've already done, you've disincentivized ratepayers, water yeah. districts, water agencies from ever being proactive.
So you would push up there for more equity in the policies if there is a drought.
I don't think you can paint all of California yeah. with one brush when it comes to water management.
Mm-hmm.
People in Sacramento don't even have water meters on their homes. They pay a significantly low amount of water on their water bill every month. It doesn't matter how much water they use. Whether they barely use the water or whether they leave the faucet on all day, they pay the same because there's no registration. They have no meters. Mm-hmm. They have no way to measure it. So they play a flat rate. Mm-hmm. We get into a water situation like we have where we, you know, are in the middle of a drought and the governor says everybody cut back in Southern California 20%. After we've invested all that money in water infrastructure, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think a more equitable, common sense approach to water management, partnering with our water agencies here on the proactive things that they've been doing mm-hmm. To become more reliant on our local water sources, focusing on water storage. You know, we passed a multi-billion-dollar bond issue at the end of last year for water infrastructure investment for mm-hmm. the whole state. Two reservoirs are going to be built out of that too. And neither one of them are located in Southern California.
Is there a place in San Diego County that you envision a new reservoir? Or would
we don't necessarily need new reservoirs, but we can definitely enhance the reservoir and the infrastructure assets that we already have. Yeah. Like we have done, again, at San Vicente Dam.
Largest dam raise in the United States history.
And so what that does is it maximizes our storage capability, find ways to connect the different reservoirs so they can move water around when they need to. There's a whole lot of things to do. And last thing I'll say is desal is, it's not the only option, but it's definitely a very important aspect to our water portfolio. You know, the country of Israel has half the coastline of California, but yet they have 5 desal plants along their coast.
Wow.
We're barely getting one. Now, you cannot tell me the greatest avenue or availability of water is the Pacific Ocean. And you can't tell me that we cannot do a better job. But it's taken 20 years to get that Carlsbad project online because of overregulation and stringent environmental policies when we know it's cost efficient now and it works.
Yeah. Of course, the other side, I suppose, would be that California does have one of the most beautiful coastlines in the world. And so there may be some, legitimate places where the environmental issues are.
You gotta have water.
Yeah. Well, that's true. So it's a difficult balance, isn't it? Let's move on and talk about the wildfire issues. Obviously, San Diego County, unfortunately, has the dubious distinction of having the 2 worst wildfires in California history. And all of the fire chiefs, when we interviewed them recently, said it's not a question of if it will happen again. It's a question of when, really, and how bad. As a state legislator, are there any things that you would try to do to improve the fire safety or fire responsiveness for our region specifically?
As a senior staff member for Congressman Hunter, both in 2003 and in 2007, when we had those fires, we learned so much from one fire to the second.
Yeah, it should be noted that Congressman Hunter Sr. lost his own home in the fire.
Yeah, he lost his house in the 2003 fire and up there in Alpine. And so we learned so much when the fires came in 2007. We were so much better prepared. Communications at different levels of government was happening very frequently. And while 2007 was very devastating, it wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been had we not taken heed of those lessons that we learned in 2003. So you're right. This is a constant threat. It's part of living out here. San Diego, and particularly East County, is a great place to live. But with it comes with the realization that a wildfire is always possible, especially during certain times of the year. And so as a state legislature, my job would be to, number one, ensure that my office would be doing everything it can to coordinate with federal and local resources to ensure state resources are in that inventory of things that we need that are available to handle it, to make sure that Cal Fire had everything that they need to be able to respond to things, and that constituents in my district know that they could come to my office on any state issues that they would have need of help with. Something as simple as getting a driver's license. If fire takes your home and your wallet was in, your driver's license is gone, it sounds like a little small thing, but when you're trying to get money out of the bank and you can't prove who you are, you're going to need help. And so what we've done, and the last time we had the fires, I was actively involved with one of these one-shop stops in Ramona, where people could go there, and they were victims of the wildfire, and they could go there and they could talk to county officials, state officials, federal officials, banking institutions, everybody to get all the things that they need to get back up on their feet. And so I think collaborating with the different levels of government, ensuring that the constituents know that we are a resource, and also constantly asking the questions, what can we do better? What can we do to be more ensure that Cal Fire doesn't have any silly regulation keeping it from doing what it needs to do? What do we do to ensure that people know where to go in terms of during a time of emergency, and they'll get the help that they need, not just talk to somebody who's going to take their name and get back to them? I think that's huge.
There you go. Question for you on a couple of the social issues. This is an area, actually, where the other two candidates do have some differentiation. Mayor Vopel, very conservative on those types of issues, whereas Mr. Tiora says that he's a little more libertarian-leaning and thinks that the government should sort of stay out of people's private lives when it comes to things like birth control or abortion or gay rights issues. What are your views on those issues specifically?
I do believe personal freedom needs to be protected. That should be the number one question that you ask when you're determining any type of policy. But I am a social conservative. I do believe in the right to life. I believe life begins at conception.
Does that mean that you would not allow exceptions for, say, if a woman's life was in danger or rape or incest victims?
I do believe that we can talk about different circumstances, whether it be life of the mother, rape, incest, and talk about the policy issues that involve that. The life of the mother is something that should obviously be taken into consideration. But I do believe that life is should be protected, and that should be the main driving force going in when you're determining any type of state or federal policy.
Thank you very much for sharing that with us. Yeah. Rape and incest seem to be difficult issues for some conservatives. Of course, there's more than one life at stake.
I think it's important to also recognize this, that the number of pregnancies that result come about as a result of rape and incest is usually less than 2%.
True.
So if you would give an opportunity to protect life in 98% of the issues, I definitely, mm-hmm. that would be something I would definitely support. It's one of those things where, you know, I understand there are very strong emotions on this. I'm on both sides of the issue. I stand on what I believe in, and I know why I believe what I believe. But, I certainly am willing to discuss it with people when they have questions about it.
Okay. We need to pause for station ID. You're listening to the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. We are talking today with Mike Harrison, candidate for the 71st Assembly District. Let's talk about veterans issues, largely a federal issue, but as a state legislator, is there anything that you would try to do to improve the conditions or care for the veterans that we have right here in California, and certainly many of them in San Diego County?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the federal government does provide a number of resources for veterans, but also the state of California has its own programs as well. And where I think our responsibility lies is to ensure that we're not duplicating those programs, that we're not reinventing the wheel or doing the same thing over. And I think that's something that you find in the bureaucracy, both at federal and state levels. Both have an intention to do right by our veterans. We owe them so much. But then they come up with a program that's already occurring at the federal level. And so, if we're investing at the federal level and it's either hitting its mark or it's not working, do we really need to repeat that at the state level? And so I think where the state government can do a better job is to find those unique areas that it can be helpful specific for state matters. I'll give you a really good example. Right now you get credit if you hire a veteran in a business, right?
Yeah.
You get credit if they're a combat veteran or if they're just a veteran. But we know that the first 2 years of any person separating from the military is the most critical first 2 years.
Yeah.
So why not create a third category? It wouldn't be that hard to say combat veteran under 2 years removed and wow. give a business a higher credit for hiring somebody in that position.
Good idea.
And that would incentivize businesses to hire those recently separated military, the veterans from the military,
yeah.
give them a tax incentive or do something to help spur job creation. And it would help those vets that are going from the military into the unknown, give them more job opportunities.
Yeah, good idea, because
right?
certainly there's a staggering level of homelessness and suicide and joblessness. Often
absolutely. So there are little common sense things like that, and I don't mean little like they're not important, but I mean there's just some common sense ideas that we can take advantage of that would help protect that population mm-hmm. that's not trying to reinvent something that's already happening at the federal level. When the federal government is not meeting its responsibilities, I think the state government does have a responsibility to come in and meet its responsibilities, and that's a way that can help make up the difference.
Okay, we've got just a couple more issues to get through here. Agriculture is a very big part of San Diego. A lot of people don't know that San Diego has more family farms, 10 acres or under, than any county in America, according to the Farm Bureau. And, of course, most of those are out here in East County. But we've certainly seen farmers struggling with the drought, among other things. On the other hand, we have a burgeoning agritourism industry out here that people like Supervisor Jacob and some of the other supervisors have pushed forward, you know, with things like the boutique winery ordinance. And now there's a push to support things like cheese making and beekeeping out there. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering at the state level if there are any ideas that you have for helping to support agriculture, and especially in our region where it's mostly family farms, these small businesses that are kind of on the forefront of agritourism.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it goes to the bigger issue that we were discussing before about water. If you drive through the Central Valley today, you see areas and acres of land that used to be agriculture-producing areas that are now gone barren because of the lack of water and because of the water policies. So we need to do a better job, again, going back to the water, to protect our agriculture industry. It provides the food for the nation year-round. Right. San Joaquin Valley and Imperial County are the breadbaskets. Imperial County is a $2 billion a year agriculture industry.
Huge.
And what I think we can do is get out of the way. The state government can get out of the way and let them do what they do best. And that will help promote these types of things. For example, people say, well, what about water-intensive crops? Why are they growing almonds in the Central Valley? Why are they growing alfalfa in Imperial County? They suck up so much water. Those are staple crops that we've had for generations. We've always known they've always taken up the same amount of water. So because of the water situation, now all of a sudden we're going to take that out of the circulation, where the alfalfa is 80% of the alfalfa they grow in Imperial County stays in the state of California. Mm-hmm. It feeds the cows that we use to make hamburgers out of. So if you want to eat and if you want to, you know, have your other quality of life issues, you have to protect the agriculture industry. And I think by deregulating and getting out of the way of the agriculture, allowing them to do what they do best, I think is the approach that we need to do to protect it. And likewise with these small opportunities that we have in the backcountry
like
for the wineries and the boutiques. The county's doing a good job of working its way through of how to regulate that. There's a great opportunity, huge potential out there for these small wineries to do well and to attract tourism to the area and to have people learn more about areas that they normally wouldn't go to. But sometimes they get so overregulated, they get worried about little things about, you know, who's strumming a guitar.
Is that a case where maybe sometimes the state should roll back regulation?
I think that has no place for the state whatsoever. I think that is totally a local issue. I think the county needs to work its way through it. They need to listen to the large vineyards. They need to listen to the small boutique owners, and they need to find a way to work to help the industry as a whole. I don't see where the state is going to insert itself and have any type of benefit to the industry. I think that that is a local issue, and it needs to be kept at that level as much as possible. If you want to have an effective industry, you start running it from Sacramento. Tell me a number of things that Sacramento inserts itself into, and you are better for it afterwards.
I'd like to talk a little bit about immigration and refugee issues. The latter certainly has been huge in the news in recent days with the controversy over the Syrian refugees and whether or not, you know, state governors should try to discourage the federal government from sending refugees. Governor Brown has said, yes, Syrian refugees would be welcome here. I think 25 or 30 other governors, as of when we're taping this, have said, gee, we don't think so. Certainly some others have said yes also. I would like to know what your view is. You bring a lot of insight into this issue, I would imagine, having worked for the congressman on that. What are your views about how the issue of the Syrian refugees specifically should be handled?
I think it goes down to the realization that 9/11 made border security a national security issue. Ever since 9/11, it should have always been thought of that way, and we always worked really hard to promote that. But 9/11 was the wake-up call, obviously, here in America. We have a right as a nation to defend our borders, as a sovereign nation to identify where our border exists, who's coming across. We should know who's coming across, where they're going, how long they're going to be here. If we're accepting them as immigrants legally, then we should know that. If they are going to go back, we should know when they're going to go back. We have every right to do that. I don't think we lose our compassion because we're being prudent in allowing who to come in and who not to come in. As for the Syrian problem, you have a huge disconnect, I think, between this president and the reality of the situation. And I am not an expert on this, and this is a federal issue, but the president has been very much insisting that he is going to raise, I think in the last 2 years, we've allowed 1,500 people from Syria to immigrate into the U.S. as a whole. Now it's going to go to 10,000. And despite of what's happening worldwide and despite of the events in Paris, he is absolutely uncommitted to not changing that whatsoever. And this is not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. It's a national security issue. And when he has a majority of his governors and when he has a lot of people, even within his own party in Congress, telling him we need to have a better and more secure vetting process to ensure that we know who's coming across, he should be listening to that. You know, God places people in positions of authority for a reason, but he also places people in positions around them for a reason as well. And that is to listen to good advice and to heed what's being said. He does not have a monopoly on all the best policy ideas. And on something as important as our national security, I think it would do him great benefit to listen to the concerns of other people, because there's a lot of people, particularly in this community, who are concerned. And I know that we're just like a lot of other places, that they want to ensure that they're safe. And so we need to do a good job of that. And I understand, just from watching and like everybody else, I'm obviously not a refugee, but I understand not wanting to be in that situation,
yeah,
and trying to escape from
crisis.
It. But at the same time, we have a due diligence and a prerogative to protect our own citizenry.
What about here in East County? We have about 50,000, maybe more of them, of the Chaldean Christians from Iraq, as well as, you know, Assyrian Christians and some others. What do you think is the proper handling for that? I mean, maybe it's more of a federal issue, but I do know we've had state legislators who've signed on to resolutions, for example, asking that the cap be lifted on the persecuted Christians coming out of the Middle East who are actually facing genocide over there at the hands mm-hmm. of ISIS. What are your views on that?
I feel that we have, in this time and place in our world history, we have our due diligence to vet everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think anybody who's coming from, you know, Iraq as a Chaldean Christian, or somebody coming as a Muslim from Syria, deserves the same type of scrutiny, the same type of background check to ensure that they're going to come to America, be a productive citizen, benefit the community as much as they receive benefits from the community. I think that's a better way to ensure that they assimilate. And I think we could take pride in the things that they bring from their culture, and they could take pride in the facts that they're the things that they're going to gain from our culture. And I don't think it has to be mutually exclusive. I'm always worried about these places. For example, they say a lot of the people from Somalia have been given refugee status, but they went to Minnesota and they've created this community that is entirely just within themselves. And to me, I don't think that's beneficial. I think obviously I'm very partial to America, and I believe mm-hmm. we have great history and great quality of life, culture to give. I think that's why we've been the place that people have wanted to come to for generations to start a new life. And I'm firmly proud of that. But I believe, you know, we can also learn from other cultures, and we have things to gain from other cultures. And it's great when they work together in a community. But we do have our due diligence to ensure that we know who's coming across and where they're coming from. And I think everybody should be given that type of scrutiny given this day and age.
Okay. A final question for you, Mike. If you're successful in winning this election and you go to Sacramento to represent East County, the political reality up there right now is that both houses of the legislature have a very strong Democratic majority, so you would be most likely in the minority party. What would be your priorities that you would attempt to achieve in your first term, your first 2 years up there, that you would consider to be realistic goals given the political climate in the state capitol?
I would go up there with no illusions of what the environment would be for somebody like myself. And I always like to say that politics is chess, not checkers.
Yeah.
If you do not understand the environment that you're mm-hmm. going into, or you're going to go up there and just be pound the table and yell about things and not be effective, I don't have any interest in that. I also don't have any interest in sitting there and not doing anything. I believe silence implies consent. And I believe that you need to, bring forward ideas, and, you know, I'll throw 10, 15, 20, 25 ideas against the wall. And guess what? Maybe nobody pays heed to them, but you just keep doing it. You stand on the principles that you believe in. I believe there are small victories to pick up with the big victories.
Yeah.
There are little things that every once in a while come along that you can work with people on to get things through, including people with the other party. And mm-hmm. I would be more than happy to do that if it's something that's in line with the principles that I believe in and what I think are the best interests of this community. I absolutely will do it. Also, in terms of being relevant, you know, the votes in Sacramento are important. The committee assignments are important.
That's a good question. What committees would you love to serve on?
I would love to get on something, obviously, involving water and business development. Those are the two areas that I really feel that practically we can work on to make things better in here in San Diego County, and particularly East County. I believe that water management and doing things to change the business environment so it's not, as we discussed so openly, hostile are areas that we can make a difference. But here's the thing in terms of being relevant, because I think it's a great question. Mm-hmm. You know, the two questions I get all the time is, why are you running and how are you going to be relevant?
Yeah, I would ask the same question if I were asking a Democrat running for Congress.
Yeah, where and so why I'm running is because it's important. I've talked about that. But how I would be relevant is, one, you stand on those principles. Two, you work towards those small victories as well as the big victories. But number three, while everything in Sacramento up there is important, equally important is being physically and vocally active in your district.
Yes.
Doing things to help solve problems in your district. And that's what I've been doing for 21 years.
We hold town halls down here in the district?
Absolutely. I mean, you know what? Because the best ideas that you get come from your citizenry on how to make things better, on the realtor saying, hey, here's something that's keeping people from buying new homes in a business environment, what have you. Here are small regulations that we could change. But the point I would like to make is that when you are physically and vocally active in your district, it lets people know that you're there. I've been doing this for 20 years for Congressman Hunter. When somebody comes to our office and they say, hey, we like to vacation in the Cleveland National Forest and our favorite trail is closed and we don't know why, we don't ask Congressman Hunter to go to Washington, D.C. to introduce a bill to reopen the trail at the Cleveland National Forest. We bring in the Cleveland National Forest. We sit down with stakeholders and we start working on the issue. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we don't get anywhere and sometimes we do get everywhere and we get it solved. And that communication is critical. That
first communication.
Absolutely. And so that's the approach that I get, that even though I'll be in a hostile environment in Sacramento, being relevant here at home and making a difference in people's lives so people know that I'm there to help work on the problems that they have is how you get around that. But in terms of your questions, you know, the water needs, the business environment, and cutting back on the regulation and taxes are definitely areas that I would pursue day one. I hit the ground running day one, being vocal about it, working on it, finding solutions.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Mike Harrison, who is a Republican candidate for the 71st Assembly District running to represent East County and also much of San Diego and a little piece of Riverside County up there. It's a big district. Mike, I'm going to let you have the final say today. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about you or your candidacy that I haven't specifically asked you about?
Nice. Appreciate the opportunity. And if anybody has any questions, my website's www.mikeharrison.com. They can see all my background, my experience, the endorsements that we received. The campaign is going great. Got a long way to go, but I'm very happy with where we are. And I'm excited for the new year and would appreciate your support.
Okay. We, of course, will be reaching out to the other candidates. We've already interviewed Mr. Tior and we'll be inviting Mr. Vopel on too. To be equal opportunity listeners and give you a chance to hear from all of the candidates running, as well as if the Democrats have a candidate that comes forward to declare down the road, that as well. Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
Join Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, Snoopy, and the entire Peanuts gang as they come to life in a Charlie Brown Christmas, December 4th through 19th. The Pickwick Players presents this holiday classic on the Off-Broadway live stage at Cuyamaca Street in Santee as the characters look for the true meaning of Christmas. Guests are also encouraged to bring a donation to benefit the Santee chapter of Project Linus, a nonprofit organization that provides homemade blankets to children in need. For tickets and details, visit pickwickplayers.net.
Parkway Plaza will host a holiday music festival that's free for the community now through Wednesday, December 23rd. Concerts will continue each Saturday until Christmas from 1 to 5 p.m. with performances by the Fiddle Cats on December 12th and Salvation Army Brass Band December 19th. Additional music performances on saxophone and violin will be staged Christmas week at a stage by the carousel inside the mall. For details, you can visit shoppingparkwayplaza.com.
Southern California's largest outdoor ice rink is open for the holiday season at the Viejas Outlet Center in Alpine, where you can feel the cool mountain air as you bunny hop, spin, and swizzle your way around the rink. The rink is open now, continuing through January 20th, at the Outlet Center, located across the street from Viejas Casino. Also has a water show and seasonal entertainment. For more information, you can visit viejas.com.
You're invited to join the City of La Mesa at La Mesa Shimmers on December 9th from 4 to 9 p.m. to celebrate completion of the $5 million downtown streetscape renovation project on La Mesa Boulevard in the La Mesa Village Shopping and Dining District. La Mesa Shimmer will feature a lighting ceremony at 4:30 p.m. at Palm Avenue and La Mesa Boulevard. Refreshments will be provided for during the event at two locations, plus live bands and students from Peter Pan Junior Theater will perform along the boulevard from 4 to 6 p.m. There will also be live entertainment from Fanny and the Attaboys and the Sam Johnson Trio. For more information, you can visit the City of La Mesa website.
On Friday and Saturday nights, December 11th and 12th, La Mesa Village Merchants Association will hold its annual Christmas in the Village celebration from 5 until 10 p.m. The event features carolers, fire pits, entertainment, and marching bands for family-friendly entertainment. Plus, shops will stay open late for holiday shopping. Learn more at the La Mesa Village Merchants Association website at lmvma.com.
The Alpine Women's Club will hold its 11th annual Christmas in Alpine home tour on December 12th. You will have an opportunity to scroll through five stunning country estates and visit Alpine's beautiful country garden shop. The historic town hall will be open from 1 p.m. for ticket holders to enjoy light refreshments and to pick up a surprise gift. You can get your tickets at Alpine Women's Club at Alpine Boulevard on Saturday, December 12th, starting at 9:30 a.m. Proceeds benefit the Alpine Women's Club Scholarship Fund and maintenance of the historic town hall, which was built in 1899. For more information, contact Karen at her email, karenhouse64@yahoo.com.
You're invited to a holiday open house at Alpacas of San Diego on Highway 79 in Descanso on December 13th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Admission is free. You can learn all about alpacas and alpaca ownership to see why these animals are both cuddly and eco-friendly. Plus, you can shop for holiday gift items such as alpaca scarves, throws, socks, and plush toys. There will also be a craft table and activities for the kids, as well as a gift basket giveaway. For more information, you can visit Alpacas of San Diego on Facebook. Now for a preview of coming attractions.
You can get in the holiday spirit with a free concert at Grossmont Center in La Mesa on December 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. The show features young singing sensation Marissa Grace and her band performing Christmas classics and pop hits near the fountain in front of Macy's.
Grossmont Center invites you to a holiday fest on December 19th from 2 until 4 p.m. Santa, his elves, and live reindeer will be on hand along with the Grinch, Frosty, the Snowman, and other holiday characters. For directions to Grossmont Center Shopping Mall in La Mesa, you can visit grossmontcenter.com. That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our festivals and events section online at eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Brian Boykel,
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.